It's time for security now. Steve Gibson is here. Yes, it's a Patch Tuesday, but we'll save deets on that until next week. We just like to prepare you for what is about to come. We are talking about a whole bunch of interesting things. Steve's found a new favorite writer, Paul Graham. It's not sci-fi. It's fact. We'll talk about that. We're also going to talk about the failure of one of NIST's proposed solutions for post-quantum crypto and deception at scale. What's the biggest problem with viruses today? It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 883, recorded Tuesday, August 9th, 2022. The Maker's Schedule. This episode of Security Now is brought to you by Collide. Collide is an endpoint security solution that uses the most powerful, untapped resource in IT, end users. Visit collide.com/securitynow to learn more and activate a 14-day free trial today. No credit card required. And by ExpressVPN. When your phone carrier tracks you, that's a gross invasion of privacy. You can keep letting them cash in on you, or visit expressvpn.com/securitynow to get the same VPN I use. Take back your online privacy today and use our link to get 3 extra months free. And by Drata. Security professionals are undergoing the tedious, arduous task of manually collecting evidence. With Drata, say goodbye to the days of manual evidence collection and hello to automation. All done at Drata speed. Visit Drata.com/twit to get a demo and 10% off implementation. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover the latest in security, privacy, bad guys, good guys, white hats, black hats, gray hats, and Steve Gibson, who doesn't need a hat.
Even really smart people.
Even them.
We got two really smart people that are topics. Dan Bernstein, who is one of my favorite cryptographer mathematicians, and the person who's responsible for the show's topic, a guy by the name of Paul Graham, who I'll be introducing people to who may not know of him. He'd really never crossed my radar one way or the other, although he's long been on yours, Leo.
Oh, yeah.
This is Security Now, episode 883 for the 9th of August. This is Patch Tuesday. So next Tuesday, we'll find out what happened.
Now I know why my Windows machine was so slow starting up this morning.
Yeah, and why I've been saying, no, please don't reboot right now. Yes. I'm trying to do a podcast.
Yeah.
So we're going to examine the collapse of one of the four NIST-approved post-quantum crypto algorithms.
Oh, good. I was hoping you'd do this. Yes.
Yeah, we just announced them a couple weeks ago, and, you know, remember Scotty's dilithium crystals and so forth. Anyway, we lost one. But the lessons it teaches us are very important. We're also going to look at what VirusTotal has to tell us about what the malware miscreants have been up to lately, based on all of their stats. And at the conditions under which Windows 11 was corrupting its users' encrypted data. Yes. Gotta love those upgrades. We also celebrate a terrific-looking new commercial service being offered by Microsoft. I'm not quite sure what it is from their description, but it looks great. And we briefly tease what will probably be next week's topic, which is cryptographer Daniel Bernstein, as I mentioned, his second lawsuit that he's filed against the United States. Before we get into the other stuff, the end of the show stuff, we'll talk about that. I'd also want to share a bunch of interesting feedback, sort of more of in a sort of a Q&A style from our terrific listeners. And then we're going to wrap because I want to share my discovery of a coder, a serial successful entrepreneur, and a surprisingly good writer by sharing something that he wrote which I suspect will resonate profoundly with every one of our listeners. So today's title is part of the title from one of Paul Graham's essays. This is The Maker's Schedule. And, we've got a great picture of the week. I will do my best to describe it. I saw it. I thought, oh, this is just too perfect.
Oh, a big show coming up. And I'm looking forward to, Paul Graham has been around for ages. He's founded Y Combinator, which is a big, startup incubator in the Bay Area and very well known.
More than 3,000 startups.
Yeah, some of them huge.
Boy.
Yeah.
And many that we all know.
Yeah, absolutely. But also a great thinker, brilliant, I agree with you, brilliant writer and an essayist, and Lisp aficionado.
Yes, he is. Near and dear to your heart.
You bet. But first, a word from our sponsor, also near and dear to our hearts, Collide. Actually, I am a big fan of Collide because I like their philosophy. You know, when you're protecting a business, if you're in the security business or the IT business and you're protecting a business, the temptation is just to lock everything down. We've talked about that, filling the USB ports with super glue and preventing people from doing anything. But I think what we've learned in this BYOD world is, you could use MDM and lock everything down, but what users end up doing is they become your adversaries. They don't like this, and they end up trying to get around it, end up maybe even using their own devices, which, of course, is far worse, and maybe even bringing those devices now infected into the enterprise, and you have no control over that. So there is a better way, and that's Collide, K-O-L-I-D-E. It's endpoint security that uses the most powerful untapped resource in IT, your end users. See, it turns out that instead of making your end users adversaries, the bad guys, turn them and their devices into your allies. Old school device management tools like MDMs force disruptive agents onto employees' devices. And employees know this. They slow performance. They treat privacy as an afterthought. They're good for you, but they're not good for the users. And then you turn in, IT into admins and end users into enemies, and it creates its own security problems because users just turn to shadow IT just to do their jobs. It's not a good scenario. You've probably been through it already. That's why you want to take a look at Collide. Now, you need to be using Slack. So this is for enterprises that use Slack. We do. Slack is, of course, very widely used as a messaging system in enterprises. And this is where Collide does things very differently. Instead of forcing changes on users, Collide sends them security recommendations via Slack. In fact, it all begins with their first notification, helping them, walking them through the process of installing the Collide user agent and explaining why they need it, what it's going to do. And then Collide will automatically notify your team when their devices are insecure and give employees step-by-step instructions on how to solve the problem. It's so much better, let me tell you, from both points of view. By reaching out to employees via a friendly Slack DM instead of educating about a company policies instead of just saying, no, no, no. Collide helps you build a culture in which everybody contributes to security because everyone understands how to do it and why to do it. Now they're your allies. And it's so much better it's frankly a necessity to have everybody on your team get behind the idea of security, to not understand it, to buy into it, to know how to do it. For IT admins, you'll love it. Collide gives you a single dashboard. You can monitor the security of your entire fleet. And by the way, completely cross-platform, Mac, Windows, Linux. You could see at a glance which employees, for instance, have their disks encrypted, which ones are up to date on their OS patches, their password managers installed, things that make it easy to prove compliance to your auditors, your customers, to your leadership. So this is, in a sense, this is in a nutshell, this is what Collide is. User-centered, cross-platform endpoint security for teams that Slack. And if you're using Slack, I really want you to look at this. You can meet your compliance goals by putting users first. Honestly, visit Collide, K-O-L-I-D-E, collide.com/security now to find out how. If you follow that link, you're going to get a great goodie bag, including my Collide t-shirt, which you will be proud to wear everywhere, suitable for black tie events. You'll get, there's more. I got another one. Look at this. Oh, this is another one. I like this. with the Pinocchios or something on the back. What is that? Yeah, it's Pinocchio. Client security. You'll get stickers suitable for your laptop. All of that just for going to collide.com/security now and activating the free trial. Got to try this. K-O-L-I-D-E, collide.com/security now. I just love this idea. All right. Back to Steve and the picture of the week.
So the way to describe this, we don't often get like thick fog in Southern California, but I spent the first third of my life in Northern California.
Yeah, we get it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy. And especially like Sacramento, driving like around the Sacramento area, for some reason, like, you know, this super thick fog. So remember how, if you've ever driven in fog, how you all you can see are the lights of a oncoming car. You know, there is just, you know, two white glowing things in the darkness, or even in the day, depending upon, you know, what time of the day the fog is. But so the point is that the fog obscures everything that's not lit up. Okay, so, and I have to say, this picture of the week, it's worth getting the show notes just to see this, because this was an actual photo taken. In the distance is a digital billboard, which has I know, it's just so good, which has crashed, and or for some reason caused its backing Windows OS to display an error message in a dialog box. So you don't see the normal. So the billboard itself is not displaying whatever ad it normally would. Instead, it's this dialog box. And because this is taken on a foggy night, all you see is it, like hovering in the sky is this eerie glowing Windows error dialog. And so the caption on this great photo says, "A digital billboard in Odessa malfunctioned in the fog, convincing unknown numbers of motorists not only were they living in the Matrix, but it was being run on Windows 98. So, anyway.
That we know can't possibly be true.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case. But anyway, just a great picture. So thank you, whomever it was, a listener of ours who sent that, saying, hey, I think this would be a picture of the week. Boy, were you right. Absolutely. Okay, so we already know crypto is hard. In fact, it's even harder than we know. Okay, how many times have we observed the fallacy of rolling one's own crypto? And even when professional academics carefully design, test, and vet an algorithm, they sometimes get it wrong. The biggest news of the past week in the crypto sphere is the fall of one of those four final and chosen post-quantum cryptographic algorithms. But to their credit, even while NIST was announcing their final status, recall that everyone was told not to commit them to code just yet. Well, that turned out to be sage and prescient advice. Some guys whose work we've covered in the past, the researchers with the Computer Security and Industrial Cryptography Group at KU Leuven, managed to break one of those four late-stage candidate algorithms, which was like ready to be deployed like soon for post-quantum encryption. Fortunately, the dilithium crystals are still intact. Those algorithms are okay. The algorithm they cracked, PSYKE, S-I-K-E, which is the abbreviation for super singular isogeny key encapsulation. It made it through all of the earlier stages of the U.S. Department of Commerce's National Institute of Standards and Technology, you know, the NIST competition. So that competition has been running since 2017, 5 years ago, and started out with 69 candidates in its first round. That weeded the number down 2 years later to 26 surviving candidates from the 69. That is to say, all the other ones, something was, like, problems were found. It could have been performance. Most likely, it was some security problems, like there were defects found in some of those. Then the next year, which brings us to 2020, the third round, we had 7 finalists with 8 alternates. And as we know, when we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, this was the end of the fourth round where we had 3 finalists and 1 alternate being selected to become the standards. So the good news is, even after the announcement of the final 4, or perhaps because of the announcement of the final 4, the KU Leuven researchers rolled up their sleeves and got to work. They approached the problem, however, from a different angle than the cryptographers who designed it. They came at it from a pure math angle, attacking the core of the algorithm's design instead of any potential code vulnerabilities, like, you know, which is actually how a lot of these previous candidates got weeded out, as I mentioned. Sykes' base encryption was based upon something known as super singular isogeny Diffie-Hellman, or SIDH for short. But the mathematicians were able to show that SIDH itself was in turn vulnerable to a pure math attack, which had been developed back in 1997, known as the glue and split theorem, which is an attack on elliptic curves. In response to this, like the discovery of this, Sykes' co-inventor, David Yao, a professor at the University of Waterloo, he said, quote, "The newly uncovered weakness is clearly a major blow to Psych," which is, you know, you can imagine he's feeling a little protective of his algorithm. So, in other words, you know, it killed it, you know, or as McCoy would have said, it's dead, Jim. And he added that all this goes back to cryptographers' sometimes imperfect dominion of pure mathematics, in that the approach taken by the researchers, he said, was really unexpected. Well, in any event, unexpected or not, it wasn't going to be good enough. So essentially this means that the researchers used math rather than mechanics to understand Sykes' encryption scheme and were then able to predict and then retrieve its encryption keys, which is specifically what it was designed to protect. And for their efforts, they received a bounty award of $50,000 from Microsoft after they published their paper titled "An Efficient Key Recovery Attack on SIDH." And although not directly on Psyche, SIDH being the basis for Psyche, they are the same. The people who've been watching and participating in this process are concerned that this appears to be as difficult as it is. In a note which was written, an email actually, to Ars Technica, which Ars Technica published, Jonathan Katz, an IEEE member and professor in the Department of Computer Science at the University of Maryland, wrote, quote, "It is perhaps a bit concerning that this is the second example in the past 6 months of a scheme that made it all the way to the third round of the NIST review process," and in this case, the fourth round, "before being completely broken using a classical algorithm." He added that, quote, "3 of the 4 post-quantum crypto schemes rely on relatively new assumptions whose exact difficulty is not well understood. So what the latest attack indicates is that we perhaps still need to be cautious and conservative with the standardization process going forward. Unquote. In other words, we knew crypto was hard, but now it appears that it might be even harder than we thought it was. And part of the process is we're stepping into it like into unfamiliar territory, pre and post quantum. They're like, it's a whole different thing, a whole different nature of computing that we're needing to be hardened against compared to classical computing, which is what we've been using until now, right? So there's a lot of understanding and basis for grokking the way computers work today. That's not the way they work tomorrow. So, you know, we've already been doing this work on for like working to come up with the algorithms which will be able to rely on post-quantum for 5 years. And thank goodness that as an industry, we started as early as we did and that we're now focusing upon this as intently as we are. Even though it's true, sufficient, and you and I, Leo, have had some fun with this, that sufficiently powerful quantum computers still seem to be a safe distance away. Have they factored the number 31 yet? I don't know. It's increasingly looking.
I think 31's a prime, though, so I think that may be way off. if they factor 31, then we got a problem.
Okay, how about 27? Let's go with that.
There you go.
Or 35, I think is what I meant. Anyway, it's interestingly looking as though we're going to need more time than we thought to get ready. And remember that everything being encrypted and stored today, still under pre-quantum crypto, is potentially vulnerable to disclosure once sufficiently capable quantum computing emerges. And at some point, depending upon what it is that's being stored, it might even be worth upgrading existing stored encrypted data at rest from its current pre-quantum encryption to post-quantum encryption. In other words, read it, decrypt it under pre-quantum, re-encrypt it under post-quantum, and then store it back. Now, of course, the NSA, they're happily storing everything that they can get their hands on, presumably, that is pre-quantum, and I wouldn't be surprised if they're, you know, one of the first people to order one of these big monster post-quantum machines as soon as they are available.
So they have. So just to be clear, it's kind of confusing. You mentioned dilithium, crystals dilithium. They have four already standardized four candidate algorithms, which are crystals Kyber, crystals dilithium. Crystals Kyber is the KEM or key establishment mechanism, and then there's crystals dilithium, Falcom, and Sphinx. This was part of a second class of four that Psyche was part of a second class of four that they were looking at.
Right. Right.
So it doesn't undermine what they've already done, although it does, as you say, make us wonder, you know, how good these things are. And I think they already say they're going to standardize on crystals, Falcon, and Sphinx, right?
Correct. So the lattice-based algorithms, you know, cryptographers and mathematicians have been working with lattice-based crypto already for some time. So it's reasonable to hope that those are going to be stronger and more resistant to, I guess, what we would call new approaches to cracking them. And of course, we want every possible approach, right? I mean, we want something that is absolutely resistant, and because the worst thing that could happen would be that the whole world standardizes on something that we all collectively believe is super solid, and then some complete crack is found.
You mean like DES or something like that?
Kind of like that.
Yeah.
Although generally we've, you know, in the case of DES, it was the NSA who said, you know, I think maybe you want to do that three times rather than just once.
Right.
And thus, you know, triple DES was found to be sufficiently secure because just doing it three times, each time with a different third of the whole key, you know, resulted in enough security margin. So
this does point out this is a good process. You know, that's what you hope.
Yes.
Is if somebody comes along and says, no, you can't use that one. That's why you do this.
Oh, yes. And so this was useful in two ways. It both took one of the not safe enough contenders out of consideration, and it sort of shocked everyone. It's like, wait a minute. Yeah. And this is the point that this guy was making, was this thing made it through 5 years of scrutiny, through down to the fourth round where people were so tired, they finally said, okay, fine. You know, we've been picking away at this thing for 5 years. There are these four. They all look fine. Well, they were wrong about one of them. Are we sure they're not wrong about the other three?
Right. Well, that's the point. They weren't 100% sure of any of those four. They aren't the four candidate algorithms that they've put forward for standardization. These were the second choices anyway. But I'm glad they got rid of one. And I hope they continue to look at the four that they have decided to standardize.
And it's fair to say that they got rid of the one that was the less well understood of the four.
They liked it because it had a small key. You know, it is.
Yeah, and I like the other ones because they got dilithium in them. So
can't go wrong with that.
That's great, you know. Either warp engines or lightsabers, one way or the other.
Yeah.
Okay, so VirusTotal. Last week they published a report titled Deception at Scale, where they laid out the terrain of the malware samples that are uploaded to them more or less constantly to be analyzed. You know, they sit in the perfect place to see what's going on. They've got great, you know, scope. I've explained in the past that signing my own executables, I discovered the hard way because people were saying, hey, Windows is saying this is not safe. You know, you got a virus. It's like, no, I don't. Actually, it didn't say that. It just said, this is, you know, you don't have any reputation here. So the point is that signing my executables was not sufficient proof of the integrity of my apps to bypass various of what are now hair-triggered malware cautions. But VirusTotal reported, among other things, get this, that fully 87% of the more than 1 million malicious samples which were signed at the time they were uploaded to VirusTotal since the start of last year, January 2021, contained a valid signature. 87% had a valid signature, those that were signed. So what that tells us is that signing code no longer means much. It's necessary but not sufficient. The bad guys are arranging to obtain code signing credentials, just like any other legitimate, you know, code publisher would, you know, just like I do. So moving forward, the only thing that can be used, can be relied upon, is the reputation of the hash of a given executable that is earned over time. Any new hash will need to start over from scratch, earning the reputation that specific exact code that it's the hash of is trustworthy. And there was another little interesting tidbit. If you care to protect yourself somewhat by inspecting the certificate authority who issued the AuthentiCode certificate that was used to sign a program which you're considering running, it's worth noting that more than 58% of the most often abused code signing certificates were all issued by just one company, a certificate authority known as Sectigo. And if the name Sectigo isn't ringing any bells, it's probably because they renamed themselves after their repeated conduct spoiled and soiled their previous name, which was Komodo. It's, you know, we've talked about Komodo quite a bit in the past, all the different mistakes they made, like allowing people to, you know, create their own certificates through problems in their web interface and giving code certificate minting authentication to people who didn't warrant it and so forth. Anyway, I imagine that they're the favorite of malware authors mostly because their certs are less expensive than the competition. And, you know, really, it's not their fault that VirusTotal sees most malware signed by their certs, since anyone can purchase a code signing certificate from any certificate authority. So you're going to go with the cheapest. I don't, but I don't want to be signed by Komodo, now named Sectigo. You know, and it's, the whole thing is roughly analogous to what Let's Encrypt did to TLS connections, right? Once upon a time, having a web server certificate meant something. Not anymore. Today, everyone needs to have one, and they mean nothing because they're just being minted by automation based on the domain of the server that they're sitting behind. So, okay. Anyway, VirusTotal also revealed that the top three most often spoofed programs were Skype, Adobe Reader, and VLC Player. Malware is masquerading as those three utilities, one of those three, Skype, Adobe Reader, and VLC, as the top three, as basically, obviously, as a means to abuse the well-earned trust that they've earned, that those apps have earned with users everywhere. And while those are the top three, the top 10 are rounded out by 7-Zip, TeamViewer, CCleaner, Edge, Steam, Zoom, and WhatsApp. So, yeah, you know, the top of the popular apps that people are needing now to grab wherever they are. So VirusTotal said in their report last week, one of the simplest social engineering tricks we've seen involves making malware look like a legitimate program. The icon of these programs is a critical feature used to convince victims that these programs are legitimate. Just the icon. Of course, no one is surprised that threat actors employ a variety of approaches to compromise endpoints by tricking unwitting users into downloading and running seemingly trusted executables. The other way this is achieved is by taking advantage of genuine domains, at least like, you know, the top level or second level domains, to get around IP-based firewall defenses. Some of the most abused domains which VirusTotal has seen are discordapp.com, squarespace.com, amazonaws.com, mediafire.com, and qq.com. In total, more than 2.5 million suspicious files were downloaded from 101 domains belonging to Alexa's top 1,000 websites. In other words, the top 10% of the top 100 website domains have been used as sources for malware. And the misuse of Discord has been well documented, with that platform's content delivery network becoming a fertile ground for hosting malware alongside Telegram, while also offering a perfect communications hub for attackers. So ultimately, checking anything that's downloaded, which might be suspicious, against VirusTotal I think, is the best thing anyone can do. As I mentioned a while ago, back when I was needing to bring old DOS machines onto my network in order to debug SpinRite on them, I was sometimes needing to go to well-off-the-beaten-path driver repositories to locate old drivers for old network adapters. Driver repositories are classic sources of malware. So in every case, I ran anything that I downloaded past VirusTotal to make sure that it didn't raise any alarms. And normally you get like one or two, some weird, obscure, you know, VirusTotal, I think, scans as across or against as many as 75 different virus, you know, antivirus engines, and you'll typically get a couple reds, misfires, false positives from some scanners you probably have never heard of. And so, you know, that's not a problem. It's when you see like 20 or 30 of them lighting up red that is like, okay, do not click this thing so that it's able to run. And you know, stepping back from all this a little bit, it's so annoying that so much of, you know, energy is being spent holding back the forces of darkness. Look at how much we put in now to doing that. But, you know, on balance, it's worth it, because what can be done with computers today is truly amazing. Leo, I think I'm going to take a sip of water.
Okay. Right.
And you can tell us why we're here.
Maybe we should underscore, don't download drivers from third parties.
No.
Steve's a trained professional. Do not try this at home.
Good advice.
Yeah. It just makes me really squeamish.
And believe me, it made me just like I was.
Is it because they were gone? They were no longer available? Is that why?
Oh, yeah. You try to find a driver for a 1986 network interface card. I mean, it's just for DOS.
I guess
DOS,
you have no choice. Yeah.
For DOS.
Yeah. What are you going to do?
And, you know, it's a high level of pucker factor.
Yeah. But,
you know, so, and I wouldn't run them on Windows. I ran them. I moved them immediately to DOS.
Smart.
And there's not much you can do on DOS.
Exactly.
Basically, if a virus comes alive on DOS, it's like, oh, crap.
You know? Seriously. That's a virus that's been hanging out for a long time. It's pretty that's a geriatric virus.
Yeah. It's like, what's 32 bits?
I don't know what this Windows thing you're talking about is.
That's right.
Let me talk, as long as we're talking about protecting yourself, about another way to protect yourself online, and that's with a good VPN, virtual private network. And you know the only VPN I recommend, the only VPN I use, is ExpressVPN. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But chiefly, I know how ExpressVPN does what it does. And that gives me absolute confidence that they are not logging my presence there, that they cannot log my presence there, that nothing I do on ExpressVPN can be subpoenaed or otherwise acquired by governments or bad guys or marketers. It's truly private. Their trusted server technology is actually super cool. There's a good write-up on it on Bleeping Computer. They actually have a custom version of Debian. They run on all their machines. They have servers all over the world, by the way, which is great. I'll explain why that's a good thing. But they run this custom Debian a distro that, by the way, every single time, basically every day, the whole drive is wiped, the whole thing is reinstalled. The trusted server that's running on that loads itself into RAM, so when you start using a server, you have your own server, your own VPN server running in RAM only, sandbox, so it can't write to the hard drive. And the minute you stop using it, goes away. No one else has used it. No one else can use it. I can go on and on. They really go the extra mile. Of course, they're audited regularly, so you know they're doing the right thing, respecting your privacy. Why would you want to do that? Well, everybody and their brother's trying to find out what you're up to, where you're going. You saw Amazon is trying to buy Roomba, the Roomba vacuum cleaner, not because they think it's such a great business, but because it has maps of your house that they upload to the servers. Everybody wants to know what you do. Your phone is the ultimate espionage device. You do everything on it, right? And your phone carrier, what are they doing? Collecting data on everything you do. In fact, Verizon not only admits to it, they are constantly coming up with new technologies to track you better. To track you better. They say it's so they can, I love this, better understand your interests. Oh, yeah, sure. Well, of course. Really, all they want to do is sell that information to advertisers. Stuff like sites you visited, what you've been up to online. The more they can get on you, the larger their paycheck becomes. Thwart your carriers. Thwart everybody by using ExpressVPN. They can't see what you're doing. All it takes is a tap of a button. All your network data is now encrypted, rerouted through ExpressVPN's secure servers. Again, this is why it's so important that you trust ExpressVPN. They can see that information, except they can't record it. They can't write it down. It gets wiped every day, so you don't have to worry about it, right? Whether you're an iPhone user, an Android user, a tablet user, ExpressVPN works everywhere. Smart TVs. You can even put it on some routers, protect your whole home. Of course, Mac, Windows, Linux. One subscription can be used on 5 devices at the same time. They're not nickel and diming you here. So your whole family can use ExpressVPN all at once. You know, and then I love it because they are all over the world. That means you can use an ExpressVPN server in another country. That means you can do things like watch content on Netflix in that country. It's just the right way to go. When your phone carrier tracks you, that is a gross invasion of privacy. You can keep letting them cash in on you, or you can go to expressvpn.com/security now. It's the only VPN I use and recommend. Take back your online privacy. If you use our special link, the Security Now link, you'll get 3 months free with a 1-year plan that brings the price down below $7 a month for up to 5 simultaneous users. That's a great deal. ExpressVPN.com/security now. ExpressVPN.com/security now. We thank them so much for supporting Security Now. I appreciate the work they do to make sure they are secure and they are private. And I invite you to support Security Now by checking it out at expressvpn.com/security now. Back to you.
And it just occurred to me that everything you've just said, Dem, is another example of what we're going through these days. Just to have some security and privacy. It's like, my Lord.
Oh, there is there's a story about a mother and daughter in Nebraska who just got arrested and charged with felonies. And how did the authorities get the information? They subpoenaed their Facebook DMs.
Wow.
You know, we're really now in a situation where the government is happy to use these technologies against you. And I think we now all need to have defend ourselves.
And it's why the big question is whether encryption will be allowed to survive.
I'm sure they won't. They hate this. They hate this, you know.
Yep.
They don't
it's
want
just
you
a matter
to be private.
Of, yep. Just a matter of time.
Yep.
So, 2 stories about Microsoft. One, the first is a little rough, but the second, I give them some props. The rough one is, last week, Microsoft warned that their knowledge in their knowledge base article, KB 501-7259, that, quote, Windows devices that have the newest supported processors might be susceptible to data damage. Now, though their poorly worded title doesn't make it clear, it's not the Windows devices with the newest supported processors that might be damaged. It's users' encrypted data that has been damaged by the simultaneous use of Windows 11 with the new vector encryption instructions that are present only in the latest processors. Microsoft's posting explained that, quote, Windows devices that support the newest vector advanced encryption standard, you know, advanced encryption standard is AES, the Rheindahl cipher. So this is VAES instruction set, are susceptible to data damage. The affected Windows devices are those that use either AES XEX-based tweaked codebook mode with ciphertext stealing, which is AES-XTS, and that meant something to me. I'll explain in a second. Or AES with Galois counter mode. That's, of course, GCM. So AES GCM. Both of those immediately raised my eyebrows, since AES GCM has become the preferred authenticating encryption mode for bulk encryption, and AES XTS is the way data at rest is stored encrypted in mass storage. And sure enough, in their knowledge base article, Microsoft wrote, to prevent further data damage, okay, to prevent further data damage, we addressed this issue in May 24th, 2022 preview release and the June 14th, 2022 security release. After applying those patches, they said, you might notice slower performance for almost 1 month. And I thought, what? A month? What? They said, after you install them on Windows Server 2022 and Windows 11, they said Paren's original release. The scenarios that might have performance degradation include BitLocker, Transport Layer Security, you know, TLS, and disk throughput, especially for enterprise customers. In other words, the previously faulty encryption that was being used by Windows 11 for BitLocker and TLS communications was fast but broken, and it was damaging its users' data. So they fixed that quickly in May and June by no longer using the VAES instructions at the cost of performance, which is why they said you may notice things going slower, but at least your data is not being scrambled. They wrote, if this affects you, we strongly urge you to install May 24th, 2022 preview release or the June 14th, 2022 security release as soon as possible to prevent further damage. Then they said performance will be restored after you install the June 23rd, 2022 preview release or the July 12th, 2022 security release. In other words, you know, they're saying that they found and fixed the broken VAES implementation and have restored Windows 11 to use VAES with the most recent updates. So now you get speed and, happily, it's not damaging your data. So this was all resolved by last month's patch Tuesday, but there was a period, and no one really knows how long it was, where Windows 11, when used on the most modern processors, which had this VAES set of instructions, the vector AES, had broken Windows Core crypto algorithms. Microsoft wrote, quote, we added new code paths to the Windows 11 original release and Windows Server 2022 versions of SimCrypt to take advantage of VAES, the vectorized AES instructions. SimCrypt, they wrote, is the core cryptographic library in Windows. These instructions act on advanced vector extensions, AVX registers, for hardware with the newest supported processors. Okay, now, obviously, whatever these bugs were, they were not destroying everyone's data, we would have known about that. Or perhaps it was just that very few people were using Windows 11 original release on the very latest processors, which also had these new VAES instructions. But in any event, it's a bit frightening to have this somehow escape from and to be shipped by Microsoft. Bleeping Computer carried this story, and someone commented on their story on its page by writing, quoting the phrase data damage, and said, data damage, the new marketing gloss over for data loss and file system corruption. He said, don't be fooled. It's yet another case where Microsoft's bungled agile development practices have screwed the pooch. Their testing harnesses are entirely inadequate to support the massive legacy code bases they have to support in the timescales they need to release. And I think that's an accurate criticism. As we know, this is, you know, we've seen lots of evidence of this increasingly in the last couple of years. I don't think that Paul, Mary, Joe, or I could have summed things up better than that. But on the brighter side, I also have some happy Microsoft news to share. They've announced a new security offering, which looks pretty good to me. It promises to provide security teams with the means to spot internet-exposed resources in the organization's environment that they may not be aware of. On the front page announcing this new, what Microsoft calls the Microsoft Defender, and Paul and Mary Jo the other day said that, you know, pretty much everything was now called Microsoft Defender.
Yep.
You know, so it's Microsoft Defender this or Microsoft Defender that. You know, they're liking that jargon a lot. Anyway, this is the Microsoft Defender External Attack Surface Management. And on the announcement page, they note the highlights. They said, discover unmanaged resources. Understand the full extent of your attack surface, including shadow IT and assets created through common everyday business growth. Multi-cloud visibility. This is the first time I'd seen the term multi-cloud. It's like, okay, one's not enough. Let's get multi-clouds. So we got multi-cloud visibility. Maintain a dynamic inventory of external resources across multiple cloud and hybrid environments. And then finally, identify exposed weaknesses. Prioritize vulnerabilities and misconfigurations hidden in unmanaged resources. Then bring the resources under management to remove those exposures. So, okay, from everything they've written, it's unclear to me, because of the terminology they've used, whether this is an external, but, for example, a far more comprehensive scan like GRC's Shields Up service, or whether it's local network packet monitoring. If a network monitor was placed truly upstream of everything else that the enterprise was exposing, that could do the job. But it strikes me that even that could be prone to some mistakes. The focus is on mistakenly unmanaged, forgotten, or unknown network assets, which might be added to the environment after, you know, what they say, they said business growth. So mergers or acquisitions created by shadow IT, you know, somebody's uncle, you know, plugging something in somewhere, or missing from inventory due to incomplete cataloging, or just left out due to, you know, rapid business growth. And I think all of this is a great idea. Microsoft's corporate VP for security said, the new Defender External Attack Surface Management gives security teams the ability to discover unknown and unmanaged resources that are visible and accessible from the internet. Essentially, the same view an attacker has when selecting a target. Defender External Attack Surface Management helps customers discover unmanaged resources that could be potential entry points for an attacker. And I still can't figure out exactly what it is from what they've written. As I said, the language they're using is aggravatingly imprecise. Elsewhere in describing it, they wrote, Microsoft Defender External Attack Surface Management scans the internet and its connections every day. Well, okay, I don't know what the internet and its connections means exactly. Maybe Paul and Mary Jo will talk about this tomorrow. Anyway, they continue. Microsoft says this builds a complete catalog of a customer's environment discovering internet-facing resources. That sure sounds like an external scanner to me. Even the agentless and unmanaged assets. Continuous monitoring without the need for agents or credentials, which again sounds like outside, prioritizes new vulnerabilities. With a complete view of the organization, customers can take recommended steps to mitigate risk by bringing these unknown resources, endpoints, and assets under secure management within the Security Information and Event Management, and we have an acronym for that, SIEM, and Extended Detection and Response, that's XDR tools. So it sounds like sort of a Microsoft-offered Shodan scanner for their enterprise customers. Anyway, whatever it is and whatever it costs, in an enterprise environment where there might be too many overlapping regions of IT authority and without any absolutely central, single, omniscient management, this sure seems like something that would be worth pricing out and exploring for an enterprise. You know, it is just, it is so easy to make a mistake. And this might work to catch any such mistakes before the bad guys do. So I wanted to bring it to everyone's attention. I imagine that our enterprise-bound listeners may want to know about it. Okay, so I'm going to talk about Dan here in a minute. First, I want to do some closing the loop with our listeners. Someone who asked me to keep his name anonymous, so I'll just call him K.A., sent me a DM. He said, "Steve, just wanted to share my experience with Zero Patch. As you have mentioned it a few times on Security Now, I heartily recommend this program for anyone still having to support Windows 2008 servers or Windows 7 systems in their enterprise, which, as we know, have gone out of security patch cycle unless you buy it and it gets more expensive every year from Microsoft. Anyway, he says, due to business reasons, such as having to support legacy applications, anyone can sign up for the free account to get a copy of the Zero Patch Agent." And that's, you know, zeropatch.com. And he says, "and see in an instant what Windows modules are at risk and how often they are being called by the OS." That's really cool. He says, "the cost to patch a Windows system with Zero Patch is a fraction of what you would have to pay Microsoft. And the patches are installed instantly with no reboot required." He said, "I was able to protect my systems within seconds of purchasing my subscription as the agent immediately implemented the patches on my machines. I hope this is helpful to our Security Now community, as I am sure several of us would like to simply shut down non-supported Windows systems, but are unable to for business impact reasons. Please keep my handle anonymous, as I've identified myself through this message as having to support legacy systems, and I would not like anyone to trace my association with my company, which could put them at risk. Thank you for producing my favorite podcast and equipping our community with the information we need each week to digitally protect our business and loved ones' systems." So thank you, KA. I'm happy to share this information with our listeners. I think that the Zero Patch, the, you know, the Micro Patch guys do a great job, and we're often talking about them. Someone calling themselves Oak Song tweeted, "Does the CIA care about felonies when hiring security consultants? Do they just move them overseas?" Which struck me as a really good question. It's related, of course, to our more tongue-in-cheek picture of the week last week. You know, the two paths to reaching professional security guru status. I don't remember exactly what we called it. You know, one was the 20-year path of working your way up through the hierarchy. The other was, you know, be a hacker, get convicted, go to prison, get out in 14 months on good behavior, and get hired as a security professional. So anyway, I got a kick out of that. I can certainly see both sides of it. Simon Kirkman said, "Hi, Steve. I'm trying to set up a guest Wi-Fi network, and I found an issue which I can't see how you got around when you did it at home." He said, "I set up a new router for visitors to our village hall, which is connected to a modem router in an office belonging to a business, who are willing to allow internet access but not LAN access due to CCTV, etc., being on their network. My new router is set to a different subnet and subnet mask, and in theory is separate from the business network. But in practice, an IP address gets passed upstream to the other router, which then allows access. I can't see how to do this correctly, and it allows my guest users to access the business LAN. How did you do it with your smart home network?" Okay, well, first of all, I did it with my smart home network by using a non, what we affectionately, really very affectionately call dumb routers. Mine was a smart router where the individual ports were separate network interfaces, separate NICs, not a hub or a switch where all of those ports were all on the same LAN. That allowed me to assign different LANs to different ports. But there is the famous three dumb routers solution that I developed years ago on this podcast. It's a way of creating two mutually isolated networks using three simple and standard NAT routers and pretty much zero configuration. The three routers are wired in a Y configuration. We'll call it router A, connects to the internet on its WAN interface and provides internet service to routers B and C by connecting each of their WAN interfaces to two of routers A's LAN interfaces, thus the Y connection. A useful simplification for simple NAT routers is to think of them as a one-way valve where traffic can easily leave the network, passing out of the router toward the internet, but unsolicited and unexpected traffic cannot enter the network. In fact, we now utterly depend upon this feature of NAT routers to act as our internet firewalls for us. This same principle works for the Y configuration to prevent any traffic from one of the LANs from having any access whatsoever into the other LAN, because each LAN is protected by its own dumb router, which is acting as a one-way valve. Now, that requires three routers, each of which can be dumb. So, speaking to Simon, if it's feasible for you to place a third router upstream on the WAN side of both the business router and your village hall router, that would provide perfect isolation. But there is a two-router variation which might also work. Switch the roles of the two routers. Place the village hall router on the internet and connect the business router, which requires the privacy, to one of the LAN ports of the village hall router. In that way, the traffic on the business's LAN is protected by its router's one-way NAT firewall, and the village hall router that doesn't need that protection, doesn't need that. You know, it might still be able to see the village hall traffic, but not the other way around. So in other words, three dumb routers are needed for two-way privacy, but two routers can be used when one-way privacy is sufficient. So as it happens, I sent this answer back to Simon, who later replied, "Hi, Steve, thanks for that. I have a third router around. I'll look to set that up. Had not thought about doing it that way. Thanks very much."
It's nice that you can do it all wireless. That's cool.
Yes, yes. Jose C. Gomez, he said, "Hi, Steve. Here's a pretty complete demo, an explanation of how passkeys are going to work and interface between Microsoft, Google, and Apple, presented by some of their product managers and engineers." And in his tweet, he sent me a YouTube link. I turned it into this week's shortcut. He says, he finishes tweet saying, "Looks like there is no passkey sharing at all, and it's more cross-device auth and recreate." So, for those who are interested in seeing this working, the 14-minute YouTube video posted by the FIDO Alliance on their YouTube channel is very good. It has a blessedly brief introduction by a FIDO marketing person, followed by brisk walkthroughs by Google and Microsoft product managers. So, as I said, the video is this week's shortcut of the week, meaning that it's grc.sc/883. That'll bounce you to the YouTube link. So the short version is that it's all exactly what we thought. And they do succeed in making it all look wonderful. The Google guy highlights the magic created by Apple's iCloud synchronization, such that a passkey created on one Apple device will be known to all of your other Apple devices. And they show how a Bluetooth-enabled phone and a Bluetooth-enabled desktop can use a QR code displayed on a web page to allow the phone to authenticate the user on that desktop, and how the user, now having been authenticated, may then choose to create another passkey locally on that device, that is, that desktop device, so that future logins can be done natively without the phone. As we know, it's not as good as we could have had, and bridging isolated brands such as Apple, Google, and Microsoft will, this pretty much confirms it, require creating multiple functionally duplicate passkeys for every website on every machine that lacks a means of synchronizing and sharing existing passkeys. But it's the system we're going to get. And thanks mostly to the authentication automation which WebAuthn brings to finally create an alternative to the kludge of clunky form fill-in authentication, it will be better than what we've had. But implementing it on the server side, as we know, still requires some major work individually from each and every website. That's where, you know, the form fill password managers excelled, is that the websites were spoiled. They didn't have to change anything. Everything was done by filling in the form, but it's a mess. So it's going to be very interesting to see, you know, how all this transpires over the next few years. But our initial impression is confirmed in this 14-minute video. But it also, I have to say, I mean, they make it look breezy and not burdensome. It's just not as nice as it could have been.
Yeah.
Electronic Athro said, "Hi, Steve. Love Security Now and recently came across something interesting I thought I'd ask you about. At least I thought it was interesting. Maybe it's trivial and I should know better." He said, "I recently took a United flight and they allow their in-flight Wi-Fi to be used for IP-based messaging apps for free. However, they block the sending of images. So how do they detect that one is sending an image if one is using a messaging app that has strong encryption like Signal? I would have thought that since Signal does the encryption at the end, any image sent by a signal message would be indistinguishable from a text message. But after attempting to send an image, United has clearly figured out how to detect an image in a message and block it. How is this possible while maintaining signal's encryption? Okay. My guess would be that it's all about bandwidth usage and size. Text is truly tiny, whereas any image is huge, massive by comparison. So it would be easy to simply watch each user on the airplane for the rate of data that they are exchanging. And if it exceeds some very low maximum, which is all texting is ever going to be, right? Like, you know, writing some text and hitting send is a little tiny little blurch of bandwidth use. It would be very easy for them to set a very low maximum. And if they exceed that, cut them off. And also note that a simple bandwidth cap, a very low bandwidth cap, is also what United or any carrier would want. It, you know, it's sort of a nice compromise. Their travelers can trickle out in and out text for free so long as it's at such a low bandwidth as to be insignificant to them. But if you want the cap lifted, fork over some cash. Relief Twitcher tweeted, he said, at SGGRC, you're a lifesaver, exclamation point. Today, a PC in a pharmacy that I support installed Microsoft Update KB501-4666, the one that makes the duplicate USB printer and deselects the port for the original. I'm not sure why my organization let the patch through, but this PC shares a vital label printer with the rest of the pharmacy, and suddenly no one could print labels. As soon as I saw the duplicate printer with the parens copy one, close parens, in its name, I knew exactly what to do. The reason I knew was because I had listened to Security Now 881. You saved me a lot of work and my pharmacists a lot of downtime. Thank you. Oh, and he said, while I have your attention, I'll make another plea for you to read Sea of Tranquility by Emily St. John Mandel. He says, I found it to be compelling speculative fiction. I think they call it that because it's light on the sciency details, opting instead to just concede that things like time travel and domed cities exist, and to focus instead on the story of the humans in that environment. He says, I think you would like it. So, first, it's very cool when something from the podcast so nicely lines up with a real-world event. And as for his book recommendation, since I'm currently without an engaging science fiction novel, I purchased the book for $11 for my Kindle. And I have to say, it has endless, amazing, over-the-top reviews there. So it looks like an interesting possibility. My nephew, who is similarly hooked on Rick Brown's Frontiers saga, and who with me has been waiting for the next one to drop, has not yet discovered Peter Hamilton. So he's heading into Fallen Dragon before, which I'm sure he's going to go nuts over, and then I'm going to aim him at Pandora's Star. So I envy him for not yet having found Hamilton, because, boy, does he have some great stuff ahead. Martin Rojas, he said, my sister had a severe allergic reaction. He said, she's fine. But in talking to the paramedics, we talked about medical bracelets or ID cards. She has a complex medical history and medication, as do many of the people they pick up. The paramedic mentioned that if there was a card with NFC or a QR code, they could scan that information, and it would be a great help to them in an emergency. He says that part is easy, but it would also be public for anyone to scrape the info. My question is whether there is some pattern that could serve both as secure but also be easy to access by emergency personnel. I was thinking password printed in the card, but maybe there's something better. So from a theoretical privacy protection standpoint, I had two thoughts in response to Martin. The first would be to have a publicly accessible QR code that anyone could use to access medical records, which would be carried by the person, but in such a way that it was not readily accessible to anyone. For example, make it a comfortable silicone wristband that's never removed, which identifies itself as offering critical emergency information on its underside only. Thus, it provides a degree of physical privacy by physically limiting the circumstances under which someone could obtain access to the QR code. I could also, it could also make very clear what the person's most important health requirements are, which would be spelled out in the region's most common language on the underside, so that, you know, you wouldn't have to even scan the QR code. You could immediately determine, you know, what was most important, and then the QR code could provide additional backup. The second solution, which could be applied as an additional layer of privacy protection if required, would be for the QR code, which would, you know, presumably take anyone who scans it to an emergency information supply service. That could also require login authentication by an accredited and confirmed emergency services supplier. While that would offer greater privacy protection, the worry would be that the information not be made available as quickly as it could be, or, you know, maybe at all, if the authentication failed or if the provider of the service didn't have an account with the information provider. So I think if it was me, I'd worry less about privacy and more about being certain that any special medical needs, allergies, et cetera, were readily known to, you know, someone who needed to obtain them.
And I let me put in a plug here for turning on medical ID. If you have an iPhone, and all good. First responders know this, there, go to the health app, scroll down, set up medical ID. Mine is set up with my medications, my allergies, everything that first responders would need to know. The most important thing a first responder needs, I'm told by first responders, is a number to call for your next of kin, or, well, that sounds like you're dead, your nearest, you know, your in contact, emergency contact, because they often will just use that. But there is that information. iPhones have it built in. They know how to get to it. You have to press and hold the side button and the volume up button at the same time, and then swipe the medical ID slider. So it's not something a casual, you know, privacy thief would get to. Android, right, unfortunately, does not have this built in on all versions of Android, but there are third-party apps. Jointcommission.org has the information. There's one called Medical ID on the Google Play Store. Use those, because first responders know now, who doesn't have a smartphone? They know immediately to go for the smartphone. So I think Medic Alert bracelets and necklaces and other things like that have been superseded these days by your smartphone. So if Very you have cool. a smartphone, turn that on. It's really important.
Very cool. And I guess I would argue, even if you don't have any medical issues, but you do want them, an emergency responder, to be able to get a hold of,
yes,
you know, the person that you need to have notified.
Most important information of all. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So finally, Dan Bernstein sues the NSA. As I mentioned at the top, Dan is one of my favorite cryptographer mathematicians, since he's the father of the most efficient 255-19 family of elliptic curve crypto and a number of other core crypto primitives that I adopted for Squirrel and which have subsequently been adopted for use by TLS and even optionally by WebAuthn that would make it available for passkeys. And coincidentally, Dan and I independently came up with the idea that was, this is called SYN cookies, as a way to prevent resource depletion in TCP/IP stacks, which are caused by SYN flooding attacks. The idea was a way to encode the important details of the SYN packet in the replying SYNACK so that stateless connection setup became possible. Anyway, Dan was born in 1971, so he was 24 years old when, as a student at UC Berkeley, he brought his first lawsuit against the United States. Dan's 50 years old now. He wanted to publish a paper at the time with its associated source code on his Snuffle, was the name of it, the Snuffle encryption system. But that would have been illegal at the time, so he sued and won. He sued the United States and won. After 4 years and one regulatory change, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that software source code was speech protected by the First Amendment and that the government's regulations preventing its publication were unconstitutional.
Mm.
And we owe Daniel for that. I'm bringing this up today, and I called that Dan's first lawsuit because, as I mentioned already, last Friday he announced that he has now sued the NSA in a blog posting titled NSA, NIST, and Post-Quantum Cryptography, Announcing My Second Lawsuit Against the U.S. Government.
It worked once before.
Let's go. His blog post is lengthy, and I want to read, digest, and research the entire thing. So unless something more interesting pops up before next week, it will likely be next week's topic. For anyone who doesn't want to wait for me, the link to Dan's blog post is in the show notes. So I think that's what we'll be talking about next week. And Leo, after our final sponsor break, we're going to talk about somebody I just discovered who you have known about for quite a while. And a really compelling piece of his writing.
Oh, good. Can't wait. And I put into the chat room and the show notes, well, there are no, yours are the show notes, but I put into the chat room and the Discord information about turning on medical ID. Many Android phones, I know my right. Samsung Galaxy phone has that built in. Otherwise, there are third-party apps. And all iPhones, to my knowledge, support that. Our show today, Steve, brought to you by Drata. Drata, D-R-A-T-A. Is your organization finding it difficult to achieve continuous compliance as it quickly grows and scales? This is a really common problem. Is manual evidence collection slowing your team down? As G2's highest rated cloud compliance software, Drata streamlines your SOC 2, ISO 27001, PCI DSS, GDPR, HIPAA, and other compliance frameworks, and provides 24-hour continuous control monitoring so you focus on scaling securely. And let me tell you, Drata has the waterfront covered with a suite of 75-plus integrations. Drata easily integrates with your tech stack through applications like AWS and Azure and GitHub and Okta and Cloudflare and on and on and on. Countless security professionals from companies including Lemonade and Notion and Bamboo HR have shared how critical it has been to have Drata as a trusted partner in the compliance process. Their deep native integrations provide instant visibility into a security program and continuous monitoring to ensure compliance is always met. Drata allows companies to see all their controls and easily map them to compliance frameworks to gain immediate insight into framework overlap. Companies can start building a solid security posture from day one with Drata. Achieve and maintain compliance as your business scales. Expand security assurance efforts using the Drata platform. Drata's automated dynamic policy templates support companies new to compliance and help alleviate hours of manual labor. And their integrated security awareness training program and automated reminders ensure smooth employee onboarding. They're the only player in the industry to build on a private database architecture from day one. That's huge. It means your data can never be accessed by anyone outside your organization. Now, do you believe me? You need Drata. All customers receive a team of compliance experts, including a designated customer success manager, because they know this stuff's complicated and there's a lot of details. And they have a lot of experience. In fact, they have a team of former auditors working for them. They've conducted 500-plus audits, and they're available for support and counsel as well. is, do I need to keep this? Is this record important? How long do I have to keep it? Your success is their success. With a consistent meeting cadence, they keep you on track and ensure there are no surprises and no barriers. Plus, your pre-audit calls ensure you're set up for success when your audits begin. Drata, personally backed by SVCI, a syndicate of CISO angel investors from some of the most influential companies in the world. This makes a lot of sense, right? These CISOs have dealt with this. They know this is a need, and they decided, let's put this together. SVCI, that's a syndicate of CISOs, and they supported Drata in getting going. Say goodbye to manual evidence collection. Say hello to automated compliance, something the world has needed for some time. Drata. Drata.com/tweet. You can see all the G2 awards there on the bottom of the screen. It's pretty impressive. Drata.com/tweet. Bringing automation to compliance at Drata speed. I think this is so important. Drata.com/tweet. You'll get 10% off when you request a demo. Drata.com/tweet. We thank them so much for their support on Security Now. And now to Steve Gibson.
So here's what happened. When I settled down late yesterday morning to begin assembling today's podcast, I started by catching up with my week's past Twitter DMs. The first and most recent DM I encountered was from a listener named Theron Keller, who pointed to something that astounded me, and I thought it was so important that it became today's topic. He tweeted, "Hi, Steve. I'm a few weeks behind on SN. I just heard the episode where you mentioned coding all night long. Then today I saw this, and of course thought of you. I'm sure other coders would agree." So he pointed to a posting on Facebook where someone had apparently just discovered something someone else had written back in July of 2009. After scanning the Facebook posting, I followed the source reference link to the original content and thus stumbled upon the work and writings of someone I had never been very much aware of. The guy's name is Paul Graham, and here's a very brief bio of Paul that could clearly be much longer. He is a programmer, writer, and investor. In 1995, he and Robert Morris, yes, that Robert Morris, started ViaWeb, the first software as a service company. That's 1995. And I believe it was a Lisp-based storefront creating service. So ViaWeb was acquired by Yahoo in 1998, where it became Yahoo Store. In 2001, Paul started publishing essays on or at paulgraham.com, which now gets around 25 million page views per year. In 2005, he and Jessica Livingston, now his wife, Robert Morris, and Trevor Blackwell started Y Combinator, the first of a new type of startup incubator. Since 2005, Y Combinator has funded over 3,000 startups, including Airbnb, Dropbox, Stripe, and Reddit. In 2019, he published a new Lisp dialect written in itself called Bell. Paul is the author of On Lisp, published by Prentice Hall in 93, ANSI Common Lisp, Prentice Hall 95, and Hackers and Painters, of all things, which was published by O'Reilly in 2004.
I own all three. Yep.
Uh-huh. He has his bachelor's degree in philosophy from Cornell, his master's and a PhD in computer science from Harvard. He's also studied painting at the Rhode Island School of Design and at the Accademia di Belle Arti in Florence. The well-known and, you know, technology journalist Stephen Levy has described Paul as a hacker philosopher. And given what I've seen, I would tend to agree. I was curious about his PhD dissertation.
Oh, wow.
So I tracked it down.
Wow, I have not read that.
It is quite something, Leo. It's titled, I love the title, The State of a Program and its uses. You know, it's wonderfully mystical. I read the abstract. As you might expect, it's some seriously nice, pure computer science thinking. Oh, so poking around a bit more, I was getting intrigued by this guy. I looked at a couple of his Twitter postings. A recent post of his from Saturday, 3 days ago, he tweeted, "In office hours today," and I should mention, as we'll see, that his the use of his term office hours is important to him. He says, "I talked to a pair of founders who needed a new idea. It turned out they already had a great idea, but had been ignoring it because they didn't know how to monetize it. I told them to just build it. This thing could have 100 million users." And yesterday he tweeted, I love this, "Effective organizations are unnatural. The natural state of organizations is bureaucracy and turf wars. And once deprived of effective leadership, they revert to their natural state with shocking speed."
Oh, boy, is that true.
Isn't that great?
Cow. Yes.
Isn't that great?
Yes.
Oh. And looking a bit further back on August 1st, he tweeted, "The hardest people for founders to hire are so-called C-level executives because these people are the best fakers in the world."
Yes. Yes.
He said, "Even the best founders make absolutely disastrous mistakes hiring these people. It happens far more often than anyone realizes.
It really does.
Because neither party wants to talk about it. So, after nearly destroying one company, the exec cheerily goes off to their next opportunity." And, of course, this put me in mind of someone I've talked about on the podcast before, a horrible person by the name of Ron Posner, who Peter Norton hired because Peter thought he needed, you know, like an executive to run stuff.
Ooh.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyway, if you're into following people on Twitter, Paul might be someone worth following. I don't follow anyone on Twitter, but I'm really tempted to follow him. He tweets as @PaulG, and you'd be joining his 1.5 million current followers. And I'm unsure why I find this guy so fascinating. You know, that doesn't happen that often. But he's got something. So it seems pretty clear that in Paul Graham, we have a serious computer science guy with a strong creative side and a very strong entrepreneurial business side. And you know, that might be what's hooking me. He made money early in the run-up of the internet and the dot-com revolution. It also appears that he's one of those still rarer guys who didn't make it by chance, you know, by being in the right place at the right time, but then never able to again recreate that first early success. He's a serially successful entrepreneur, and he's either spent a lot of time thinking or he's very good at it. And it turns out that Paul is also an outstanding writer, which brings us to today's topic. As I said earlier, as I began reading what Paul wrote, its subject and content resonated so deeply with me, as I know it will with so many of this podcast listeners, that I knew that sharing it here would be the best possible use of everyone's time this week. It helped that there was not a huge amount of compelling security industry news this week, but I had already made the decision to share this as this week's topic before I even knew that. He gives explicit permission for his essays to be included in full in school newspapers and the like, asking that the URL to its original page be included, as I've already done several times in these notes. So here's what Paul Graham wrote just over 13 years ago in July of 2009 under the title "Maker's Schedule, Manager's Schedule." He said, "One reason programmers dislike meetings so much is that they're on a different type of schedule from other people. Mm-hmm. Meetings cost them more. There are two types of schedule, which I'll call the manager's schedule and the maker's schedule. The manager's schedule is for bosses. It's embodied in the traditional appointment book, with each day cut into one-hour intervals. You can block off several hours for a single task if you need to, but by default, you change what you're doing every hour. When you use time that way, it's merely a practical problem to meet with someone. Find an open slot in your schedule, book them, and you're done. Most powerful people are on the manager's schedule. It's the schedule of command. But there's another way of using time that's common among people who make things, like programmers and writers. They generally prefer to use time in units of half a day, at least. You can't write or program well in units of an hour. That's barely enough time to get started. When you're operating on the maker's schedule, meetings are a disaster. A single meeting can blow a whole afternoon by breaking it into two pieces, each too small to do anything hard in. Plus, you have to remember to go to the meeting. That's no problem for someone on the manager's schedule. There's always something coming on the next hour. The only question is what? But when someone on the maker's schedule has a meeting, they have to think about it. For someone on the maker's schedule, having a meeting is like throwing an exception. It doesn't merely cause you to switch from one task to another. It changes the mode in which you work. I find, he writes, one meeting can sometimes affect a whole day. A meeting commonly blows at least half a day by breaking up a morning or an afternoon. But in addition, there's sometimes a cascading effect. If I know the afternoon is going to be broken up, I'm slightly less likely to start something ambitious in the morning. I know this may sound oversensitive, but if you're a maker, if you're a maker, think of your own case. Don't your spirits rise at the thought of having an entire day free to work with no appointments at all? Oh, my Lord, yes. Well, that means your spirits are correspondingly depressed when you don't. And ambitious projects are by definition close to the limits of your capacity. A small decrease in morale is enough to kill them off. Each type of schedule works fine by itself. Problems arise when they meet. Since most powerful people operate on the manager's schedule, they're in a position to make everyone resonate at their frequency if they want to. But the smarter ones restrain themselves. If they know that some of the people working for them need long chunks of time to work in it. Our case is an unusual one. Speaking of Y Combinator, he says nearly all investors, including all venture capitalists I know, operate on the manager's schedule. But Y Combinator runs on the maker's schedule. RTM, that's Robert Morris and Trevor, and I do, because we always have. And Jessica does too, mostly, because she's gotten into sync with us. I wouldn't be surprised if there start to be more companies like us. I suspect founders may increasingly be able to resist or at least postpone turning into managers, just as a few decades ago they started to be able to resist switching from jeans to suits. How do we manage to advise so many startups on the maker's schedule? By using the classic device for simulating the manager's schedule within the maker's office hours. Several times a week, I set aside a chunk of time to meet founders we've funded. These chunks of time are at the end of my working day. and I wrote a sign-up program that ensures all the appointments within a given set of office hours are clustered at the end. Because they come at the end of my day, these meetings are never an interruption. Unless their working day ends at the same time as mine, the meeting presumably interrupts theirs. But since they made the appointment, it must be worth it to them. During busy periods, office hours sometimes get long enough that they compress the day, but they never interrupt it. When we were working on our own startup back in the 90s, I evolved another trick for partitioning the day. I used to program from dinner until about 3 a.m. every day, because at night, no one could interrupt me. Then I'd sleep till about 11 a.m. and come in and work until dinner on what I called business stuff. I never thought of it in these terms, but in effect, I had two work days each day, one on the manager's schedule and one on the maker's. When you're operating on the manager's schedule, you can do something you'd never want to do on the maker's. You can have speculative meetings. You can meet someone just to get to know one another. If you have an empty slot on your schedule, why not? Maybe it will turn out you could help one another in some way. Business people in Silicon Valley, and the whole world for that matter, have speculative meetings all the time. They're effectively free if you're on the manager's schedule. They're so common that there's distinctive language for proposing them, saying that you want to grab coffee, for example. Speculative meetings are terribly costly if you're on the maker's schedule, though, which puts us in something of a bind. Everyone assumes that, like other investors, we run on the manager's schedule. So they introduce us to someone they think we ought to meet, or send us an email proposing we grab coffee. At this point, we have two options. Neither of them are good. We can meet with them and lose half a day's work, or we can try to avoid meeting them and probably offend them. Till recently, we weren't clear in our own minds about the source of the problem. We just took it for granted that we had to either blow our schedules or offend people. But now that I've realized what's going on, perhaps there's a third option: to write something explaining the two types of schedule. Maybe eventually, if the conflict between the manager's schedule and the maker's schedule starts to be more widely understood, it will become less of a problem. Those of us on the maker's schedule are willing to compromise. We know we have to have some number of meetings. All we ask from those on the manager's schedule is that they understand the cost. So I just thought that the crystallization of that is what hit me so clearly. And I heard you getting it at the beginning of this, Leo.
Oh, yeah.
You know, what I like so much about what Paul has created here, it is the clarity of the distinctions he's made. I've often explained to my friends and family about what I call it switching cost. It is so much more efficient to stay on one thing until it's finished than to switch back and forth among multiple things. In programming, we call it context switching, and it's expensive there, too. And I definitely operate on a maker's schedule, and I always have. A day with no scheduled interruptions planned is joyous. It's a block of unbroken time I savor in anticipation and actively appreciate. And it completely explains why I was so miserable running a company with 23 employees, which was GRC's size at its peak. I liked every single employee I had. I enjoyed them as individuals. But I was worried that they were going to need something from me when I was in the middle of doing something else. And the point is, I am always in the middle of doing something else. You know? And I want to be. That's the way I want to spend my life. Pretty much most of the time, I just want to be left alone to work. And Leo, I sort of feel I have a kindred spirit, in you.
Yeah.
You know, if I'd had the wisdom back when GRC was a cauldron of chaos, I should have worked at home in seclusion 4 days a week and held office hours, as Paul does, on Fridays. On those Fridays, I would have, you know, pre-resigned myself ahead of time, not, you know, of that I would not be getting any code written that day, and perhaps I would have, you know, both been more available and less miserable and grumpy. So anyway, I can imagine many of the Maker's Schedule listeners we have here maybe sending a link to this little piece of writing to their managers, asking and pleading with them to read it. If I were drowning in a corporate setting, I think I would do so.
I am going to recommend another one, which I blogged about a couple of years ago.
Oh,
that,
good.
That goes along with this one, Steve, that he wrote in 2016 called Life is Short. Life is Short. Because it's the same premise extended even farther. You know, don't waste time on BS because life is short.
Yep. So Paul's articles page is at paulgraham.com/articles.html. It lists this and 211 other short essays. I've only poked around at them a bit, but I find something about them to be quite compelling.
Yeah, once you start reading, you won't stop.
Yes, I did not. I did not want to stop reading them, but I had this podcast to finish, and I think that before I start in on this next book, I'm going to spend some time there. At the top of his page, he says, "If you're not sure which to read, try How to Think for Yourself," or Do Things That Don't Scale, or How to Lose Time and Money. And, of course, we have Leo's recommendation, Life is Short.
Life is Short. He also wrote the article on why you should learn Lisp. So I can't help recommend that as well.
I will be getting to it.
You will.
I leave our listeners in Paul Graham's very capable hands.
Yeah, he's amazing. Great thinker. And a great writer. And those two, when you get the two together, fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I think that means you're going to go back to work. And
yes.
I'm going to go back to reading. And the rest of you, well, you could keep listening to podcasts. That's my suggestion. Steve Gibson does this show every Tuesday, 11 a.m. Pacific. I'm sorry, 1:30 p.m. Pacific. That's 4:30 p.m. Eastern. 2030 UTC. If you want to watch us do it live, that's why I say the times. You can watch it live at twit.tv/live. There's audio and video there. Chat with us live at irc.twit.tv or in the Club Twit Discord. On-demand versions of the show available on our site, twit.tv/sn. We've got 64 kilobit audio and video available there. And, of course, you can subscribe to it in your favorite podcast client as well. Steve has two unique versions of it at his website, grc.com. He's got a 16 kilobit version for the bandwidth impaired. He also has really good transcripts written by a human, Elaine Ferris. So you can read those and follow along or use them to search for parts. All of that is at grc.com. While you're there, pick up SpinRight, Steve's bread and butter. We gotta keep him in bread and butter. All you have to do right now, get 6.0. You will participate in the development of 6.1 and get it for free if you buy today, the minute it's available. grc.com for SpinRight, the world's best mass storage, maintenance, and recovery utility. Lots of other free stuff there. You can leave a message for Steve there, grc.com/feedback. But probably more useful to leave it a DM for him. His DMs are open on Twitter. He's at SGGRC. You can DM him there at SGGRC. We invite you to join Club Twit. You can buy this show ad-free for $2.99 a month. That's four episodes. It's a pretty good deal. What is that? 75 cents an episode. And there are no ads in it at all. If you want to spend a little bit more, for $7 a month, you can get all of our shows ad-free, all of them, plus access to the Discord, which is a great social event all the time, really fun, and the Twit Plus feed, which has lots of stuff before and after the shows, other things. Plus, there's shows that we don't actually put out, like Paul Thurrott's Hands on Windows. That's a club only show. A lot of times when we start a show, there's no audience, no advertisers for it. It takes us a while to build those up. It's great now because we have some revenue from the club. We can put them in the club for free there. The Untitled Linux Show is in there. Stacy's Book Club. Clara and the Sun is coming up, by the way, in a couple of weeks. Alex Lindsay's Ask Me Anything is also in the club. So that helps us do a lot of extra stuff, hands-on Mac. If you want to join, again, $7 a month, twit.tv/clubtwit. Thank you in advance. I think that covers everything, Mr. G, except to say have a great week, and we'll see you next time on Security Now.
I salute you, Leo, and I will see you in 7 days.
I salute you back.
Bye.
The live long and prosperous salute.
Security Now.